war on terror is evoked each time an American shoots a gun. The root cause of the conflicts is the same as everywhere. Environmental destruction and climate change, and the vagaries of private appropriation by the few of the social wealth produced by the many. These causes produce war and desolation, drive the poor to blame other poor people on ethnic or religious lines for their grievances, push the world to war and fanaticism, which in turn allows mendacious states to use conflict as a reason to offer a military solution to every problem.
That's Vijay Prashad, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Vijay Prashad on Truth is the First Casualty of War. The adage that truth is the first casualty of war is ascribed to Aeschylus in ancient Greece and or U.S. Senator Hiram Johnson in the 20th century. Regardless of who coined it, truth is murdered by the powerful to advance their own class interests, especially during war. Lofty rhetoric masks realities. We want peace in the Middle East, the president and his appointees loudly proclaim, like moving the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem in defiance of international law, or selling weapons to Saudi Arabia, which then turns around and destroys Yemen, or propping up the Sisi dictatorship in Egypt, or pulling out of the Iran deal, or spending more on arms than the next seven countries in the world combined. The United States of America, the permanent warfare state, uses propaganda to cover its intentions. The lies are directed primarily at its domestic population. As the global body count mounts from the ravages of Washington's militarized foreign policy, truth is the first casualty. Our guest today is Vijay Prashad. He's a journalist and scholar. He taught at Trinity College in Connecticut for many years. He's the chief editor of Leftward Books and executive director of Transcontinental Institute for Social Research. He's the author of many books, including Arab Spring, Libyan Winter, The Poorer Nations, and The Death of a Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution. He spoke at the American University of Beirut. And now, Vijay Prashad.
Truth is the first casualty of war and business. Not just war, but also business. Money tends to corral ideas, pushing its own agenda through the mass media. This is what I learned not merely from reading the great work of Herbert Schiller and Ben Bagdikian, but also from the newsrooms where I began work almost 30 years ago. I went into these newsrooms by accident. I was studying for my PhD when I found myself dragged back to my schoolboy passion of reporting. I was doing a study of an oppressed caste community when the political party that currently rules India dragged northern India into a terrible riot. These were the riots of 1992-93. I was in Silampur, on the edge of Delhi, interviewing sanitation workers when the riots broke out. The newspaper I was then associated with asked me to file some stories from this area, where the riot was particularly hideous. This was a riot against working class Muslims, where the attackers were working class people of oppressed caste backgrounds. This was exactly what my dissertation was about: working class people attacking working class people for someone else's gain. It was where I learned to report difficult and dangerous stories. The army had declared a curfew with an order to shoot at sight. I took refuge in a temple of the oppressed castes. A few hours after I was in the temple, there was a loud knock on the door. The pujari, the priest, opened the door and welcomed in a group of killers. They came with their machetes and their knives, blood in their eyes, the smell of death on their skin. "I killed many," said one young man with mischief on his person. When night fell, there was another knock on the door. An old woman stepped in. handed something to one of the men and vanished into the night. She took a great risk to be there. After all, the order was shoot at sight. No army man would ask her why she was outside. They would simply shoot, as they often did. The parcel was handed to the leader of this gang of killers. I saw him take out a syringe and a plastic bag and then shoot himself in the arm. The old woman was his mother. She had brought him his heroin. No one wants to print a story like that. These were foot soldiers of a powerful political movement backed by a section of the business elites. What the papers wanted to print and what they did print was that these riots developed out of a sense of frustration by the Hindu population against Muslims, as if to justify the riots. When the leaders of the Hindu right said that the riots came as a response to the bomb blast in Bombay in 1993, the papers later reported this as if it were true. In fact, the bomb blast took place on March 12, 1993. The riots took place in December 1992 and January 1993. The provocations of the Hindu right through 1992 and the destruction of a 16th century mosque by the Hindu right created the context for the riots. All these vanished. Our papers reported the violence as if they were a fact of nature. Things that happen, things that need no explanation, rally around the police, the forces of law and order, hope that sane minds prevail, no need to deepen our understanding of what happened. No need, in fact, to understand the foot soldiers of this violence and to trace their relationship with the local power brokers and the national political parties. Truth is bad for business. Truth is the first casualty of war and business. Not just war, but also business. There is hypocrisy and ugliness in the way we read about our reality. Both North Korea and South Korea are eager to make peace. There are 75 million people in the Korean Peninsula. They want something other than the tension that has existed for six decades. They no longer want to be held hostage by someone else's politics. Even the Japanese have indicated that they want to open a genuine dialogue with North Korea. The United States is stubborn. It does not seem to want peace in the Korean Peninsula. It seems to want the North Koreans to surrender or to be annihilated. This is what the North Koreans believe. A senior North Korean diplomat told me that he worries that the United States wants to provoke his country to war and then destroy it entirely. He looks toward Iraq and Libya for the future of his country. Neither are positive examples. Then, as if from nowhere, a story appears that North Korea apparently has continued to sell the components for chemical weapons to Syria. What is the evidence? A United Nations report that has not been released, the word of a US State Department veteran who was on a previous UN panel and shared his suspicions with the press, and unidentified United Nations member states. This is the level of the information. The New York Times journalist who wrote this story has not seen the UN report, which is unreleased, but he had spoken to William Newcomb, who was deputy coordinator of the US State Department's North Korea Working Group, and he cited the unidentified UN member state. The headline for the New York Times story is startling. UN links North Korea to Syria's chemical weapons program. The headline has no hesitation. It is conclusive. The reader will see North Korea, Syria, and chemical weapons. The associations are clear. That North Korea denied the story does not appear in a headline. There is no evidence that the Times talked to the North Koreans, nor is there evidence that they talked to the Syrians. The journalists interviewed US State Department officials, UN officials, and former US State Department officials. That's it. That's the story. This is when journalism becomes stenography. When you sit with your notepad and write your story out of the mouth of officials from powerful countries. You accept their bona fides, they are never wrong. When US aircraft drop bomb on civilians, that is an accident. When Syrian aircraft drops bombs on civilians, that is purposeful. Underneath these words lies ideology, old colonial ideology. No one is saying that the North Koreans and the Syrians are virtuous, but certainly their views should be part of the framing of a story, even if their views are pilloried and held to account. The impression of North Korea and Syria is so overdetermined that there is no need to investigate anything. One can say anything about North Korea and get away with it. Isaac Stone Fisher of Newsweek admitted, "After months of research, I have to admit that I have no idea what is actually happening inside North Korea." He blamed it on North Korea. Although, to be clear, the door to North Korea is not closed off entirely. Journalists from elsewhere than the United States and Europe go to the North. For instance, for a dossier we produced for Tricontinental, we used the photographs of Rafael Steril, a Brazilian photojournalist who traveled through North Korea in July 2017. If you go on the internet, you will find many stories written by Western journalists that say photography is banned in North Korea. "Pictures that Kim Jong-un doesn't want you to see," screams the clickbait headline. But this is not entirely true. It merely reproduces the idea that North Korea is, as Fisher wrote, in a Stalinist time warp and is inaccessible. Why bother trying to understand the context when you can merely reproduce the ideology of the powerful states? You might recall that on October 4th, 2017, a US soldier was killed in Niger. What struck me as astounding was that US Senator Lindsey Graham of the Senate's Committee on Armed Services would say, "I didn't know there were 1,000 troops in Niger." He meant US troops. The US media followed suit. So did the Europeans. So did the media of the global South that takes its cues from the Western media. If they ran the story, it was through being dumbfounded by the death. The soldier was killed near the town of Tongo Tongo, along Niger's border with Mali. This town is in the middle of a belt that is ground zero to the traffic of a series of commodities that have begun to define the Sahel and the Sahara. You have cocaine, of course. Success by United States policy has slowed down cocaine's journey from Colombia to the United States through Central America, which is why the cocaine cartels have moved their operations to North Africa, carting vast amounts of the drug by plane into Mali and Niger. The name of the airline is called Air Cocaine. Then sending it across the Sahara by individual carters, then across the Mediterranean to European markets and to Rotterdam, from where it is shipped to the United States. A walk through Gao in Mali and Agadez in Niger shows plainly the cocaine wealth. A neighborhood in Gao is called Cocaine Bugu. A leading politician who died in 2016 was known as Mr. Cocaine or Sheriff Cocaine. Billions of dollars of cocaine moved through the Sahel into Europe. You have cocaine, but you have uranium, of course. Niger's town of Arlit is one of the world's key sources of uranium. You might remember that the United States accused Saddam Hussein's government of procuring yellowcake uranium from Niger. That turned out to be a hoax uncovered by U.S. Ambassador Joe Wilson when he went to Niger and met various people, including the former president. The accusations against Iraq was false, but Arlit's mines are real. The town is a fortress of European, mainly French, mining firms such as Areva. The town out of Arlit is known as Uranium Highway. You see the pattern here? We've got Sheriff Cocaine, Cocaine Wheel, and then Uranium Highway. But you don't read about this stuff in the media. I'm coming back to the story in a second of the soldier. The uranium of Arlit powers 1 in 3 light bulbs in France. That's a lot of light bulbs. You have cocaine, you have uranium, and you have refugees, of course. And they, unlike cocaine and uranium, make the news. They make the news because they come to Europe and interrupt the fantasy of Europe's social cohesion. Since the early days of colonialism, Europe has broadcast itself as a land of milk and honey. Old colonial ideas and the wealth of Europe built from colonial labor beckons those whose lives have been destroyed by adverse policies of trade and war. It is a siren for the wretched of the earth. Refugees do not show up in the Mediterranean Sea as if from nowhere. By the time they get into their flimsy boats on the Libyan coastline, they have lived many, many dangerous lives. They have left increasingly unproductive fields in Western and Eastern Africa, fled wars in the Horn of Africa and Sudan and Syria, as well as places as far off as Afghanistan, and traveled great distances to get to what they see as the final leg of their journey. Sadly, for many Africans, the journey ends in virtual concentration camps in Libya, where refugees that Europe does not want now linger, some sold into slavery. To get to Libya, the migrants and refugees have to cross the Sahara Desert. A journey in a pickup truck takes 3 days at least. It is perilous. The refugees, and sometimes the cocaine mules, could find themselves dying from dehydration, extremists, smugglers, or the security forces, including Western security forces in the region. The Sahara is vast, hot, and dangerous. Old salt caravans, the Azalai, mostly managed by the Tuareg peoples, used to run across the desert. They sometimes still move carrying gold, weapons, and human beings. Newer caravans prefer buses, pickup trucks, and jeeps to ferry humans and cocaine towards Europe, guns and money southward. These newer caravans drive along unmarked paths, heading between sand dunes, searching for old tire tracks that have been buried in the disorienting sandstorms. The migrants huddle in the trucks. They are wearing sunglasses, their only defense in the desert. No proper account exists for dead refugees. When a boat sinks in the Mediterranean Sea, it is within sight of Europe. When refugees die in the desert, no one seems to care. Why do they come? Because their countries have been wiped out, destroyed by unfair trade policies and by the sequestration of wealth into the hands of a few. In 2003, the presidents of Mali and Burkina Faso wrote an impassioned article titled, "Your Farm Subsidies Are Strangling Us." In this article, they said that for their region, cotton is the ticket into the world market. Its production is crucial to economic development in West and Central Africa, as well as to the livelihood of millions of people there. But this industrial sector was placed in grave threat by the trade policies pushed by the West through the World Trade Organization. This vital economic sector in our countries, wrote these heads of government, is seriously threatened by agricultural subsidies granted by rich countries to their cotton producers. In 2001, for instance, cotton subsidies in the West amounted to $5.8 billion. In that same period, 2001, the US government alone, provided its 25,000 cotton farmers $3 billion in subsidy relief. That $3 billion was more than the entire economic output of the 20 million people of Burkina Faso. These subsidies undermined the cotton producers in Africa. It is what has contributed to the destruction of West Africa's economy and set in motion this refugee crisis. Trade wars are real wars. Subsidy regimes are like bombing runs. 2.5 million Malians live with chronic hunger. 3 out of 10 Malian children are chronically undernourished. 4 out of every 5 Malian children are anemic. 1 in 4 Malian children is stunted. Mali's Minister of Economy and Finance, Boubou Cisse, came to his office from the World Bank. This is not somebody who doesn't understand the World Bank, the World Trade Organization. He's not unsympathetic to capitalism and so on. So Boubou Cisse himself is dispirited by the crisis. Malnutrition killed, he said last year, and it kills a lot. The men and women who survive are affected for the rest of their lives. The crisis produced by trade policy is not only morally unacceptable, said Cisse, but what is at stake is our national economic survival. What has been the West's answer to this crisis? Not to revise trade policies, not to see the refugee crisis as a symptom of a broken global economy, not even to see that about half of Africa's refugees and migrants move within the continent and not towards the West. Along the Sahel, from Mauritania to Chad, the Europeans and the Americans have begun to build what amounts to a highly militarized border. Europe has moved its border from the northern edge of the Mediterranean Sea to the southern edge of the Sahara Desert, and it has thereby compromised the sovereignty of North Africa. France, by itself, has created the G5 Sahel Initiative that has yoked 5 African countries into a so-called partnership that allows French military bases and troops to police this region. The United States has built one of its largest military bases in Agadez, in Niger, from where its special forces operate in the Sahel and from where it flies armed drones across the region. This is in addition to a U.S. military base, largely unmentioned, in Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso, and other bases from Dire Dawa in Somalia to N'Djamena in Chad. The Europeans and the Americans say that this has to do with the war on terror, that the enemies of freedom, Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, must be held in check or destroyed. But who are these terrorists? Amongst them are certainly hardened fighters, led by men experienced in the US-led jihad in Afghanistan in the 1980s, now freshly armed and given buoyancy by the destruction of Libya. These are men like Mukhtar Belmukhtar and Abdel Malik Droukdel, eager to overthrow the government in Algeria by conducting sabotage operations against Algerian energy fields, such as in Amina's Algeria in 2013. But the work of these groups is not militancy of a conventional sort. Al-Qaeda in this region is the preeminent smuggler of cigarettes, as well as the main organizer of a protection racket for the smugglers, taking a tax of between 10 and 15% of their product. Most of their foot soldiers are motivated by smuggling rather than theology. It is as likely that the shootout near Tongo Tongo was between smugglers and the American troops than Al-Qaeda and the American troops. The war on terror is evoked each time an American shoots a gun. Neither an open border, nor a closed border, nor a drone base, nor a special operations force will end this flow of refugees into the dangerous desert. The root cause of the conflicts is the same as everywhere: environmental destruction and climate change, and the vagaries of private appropriation by the few of the social wealth produced by the many, what we call capitalism. These causes produce war and desolation, drive the poor to blame other poor people on ethnic or religious lines for their grievances, push the world to war and fanaticism, which in turn allows mendacious states to use conflict as a reason to offer a military solution to every problem. A CIA agent once told me in Afghanistan, if you have a hammer, why not use it? More is spent on military forces than on human security. A 2016 report from the Institute for Economics and Peace showed that the total cost of the infrastructure of state violence per year is about $13.6 trillion, with half of this, $6.6 trillion, going to military expenditure, and a quarter of this, $3.5 trillion, going to internal security. The total cost of violence amounts to 13.3% of the world's gross domestic product. The stated commitment by the so-called member states of the United Nations, the stated commitment of the member states of the United Nations for official development aid is merely 0.7% of gross domestic product. And most countries are at 0.2%, if not lower. 13.3% to war. Supposedly 0.7% to development. This discrepancy between aid and violence shows that the marketplace for justice has failed. The policy framework that we have in the world has little answer to the widening inequality gap and the deepening sense of despair that grips large parts of the planet. Guns intimidate people, but they do not provide them with any hope for a better future. No one will report that in July of last year in Tunis, sensitive and decent people formed the North African Network for Food Sovereignty. Nor will there be any reflection on the assassination of hope for the region that includes the assassination of Thomas Sankara, president of Burkina Faso, on October 15, 1987. Sankara, largely forgotten outside Burkina Faso, offered an alternative to the kind of deleterious trade policies and war-making culture that has now swept the world. We must dare to invest and invent the future, Sankara said. What lies before us is not the future. It is wretched. The Bangladeshi filmmaker Naeem Mohaimin and I were in Algeria 2 years ago or 3 years ago to shoot his new film that showcases the 1973 non-aligned movement meeting in Algiers, two meetings and a funeral. It's quite interesting.
You're listening to Vijay Prashad on Truth is the First Casualty of War. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of today's program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Naeem and I traveled across the city, Algiers, meeting a range of people and visiting the sites of that historical NAM meeting. It was at this conference that the third world countries pledged to push for a new international economic order. The charismatic Algerian leader, Boumediene, urged the NAM members to be far more confrontational on the world stage against imperialism. Boumediene backed the freedom fighters of his time, from the Palestinians to the South Africans. These were fighters from a different era, sharing only the gun with the Al-Qaeda guerrillas along the western flank of Syria. The line that runs from Boumediene to the Al-Qaeda leader in Syria, Julani, is broken. Naeem's film recovers the period when that older order in the third world began to fray and the current malignancies began to emerge. Boumediene, like so many radicals, would die in mysterious circumstances in 1978, a decade before the assassination of Sankara, a decade after the assassination of Patrice Lumumba of the Congo. If Europe underdeveloped Africa, as Walter Rodney, himself assassinated in 1980, wrote, then the Western powers and their friends assassinated hope in the post-colonial continent and replaced it with violence and despair. For at least 2 decades, I have walked this landscape of desolation, from Afghanistan to Iraq, to Yemen to Sudan, where once the left was strong, but then the left was actively destroyed. I have been in search of people like Fahad of Iraq, murdered in 1949, Abdul Khalek Mahgoub of Sudan, murdered in 1971, Mahdi Amel, murdered 1987, Amina Rahal, Fatima Ibrahim, comrades from Iran to Morocco. Amin Hatoun, a young Algerian filmmaker, made a short film a few years ago called Nostalgic Laziness. In this 1 minute film, which I'll show you, we see a man lying on a bed with a television set in front of him. You first see a news report of the Arab Spring protests, with the reporter commenting how Algerians, exhausted by their civil war in the 1990s, had no desire for an upheaval. The man changes the channel. Shashi Kapoor appears. He is singing, "Aye mere bete, sun mera kehna," from the film Aa Gale Lag Ja. The father in the film, in this song, tells the son to listen to him and warns him, essentially, against chaos. Syrupy nostalgia overcomes political protest. Protests that are unprepared are not always going to be successful. They can end smothered by older logics, congealed power equations that have not been shifted. The revolutionary movements of the 20th century picked up Marx's Capital or Mao's Red Book, listened to Castro's speeches, and adopted Ho Chi Minh as their icon. Those movements had a theory of the present that was rooted in its contradictions and so proposed to move the dialectic forward toward a socialist alternative. That agenda, while still alive in sections of the world, went by the wayside. These are my comrades. They just won a huge victory in Maharashtra. 100,000 farmers came to the city of Mumbai, choked the city, and forced the right-wing chief minister to accept all their demands. It's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing. Imperialism's support of religious and ethnic parties to destroy Marxist and left movements and revolutionary nationalist movements paid off. If these new struggles have a theory, it is often rooted in texts of millenarianism, forms of this faith here or that faith there, charismatic warlords here or gang leaders there. Theories of the present are often cast aside. Older neighborhoods of the Iraqi Communist Party turned themselves into stalwarts of Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi Army, while areas loyal to the Bombay Textile Workers Communist Union turned toward the right-wing Shiv Sena. Ganglords and warlords moved into areas that once gave people hope and dreams, including dreams of a kind of socialism. The bad side of history might destroy the world, but each of the wounds it makes produces, by the logic of contradictions, its own grave diggers. Wounds, in other words, populate the land called freedom. May it be so. Thanks a lot. Yeah, I mean, first important thing is that the question of how stories are remembered is as important as how we tell stories now. So the relationship between history and news is, I think, fundamental. It strikes me as completely surprising how in our profession, increasingly, our colleagues don't want to read history. They read travel books when they go places. So what's in your backpack? It's a travel book, you know. And I was quite surprised in the aftermath of the Iraq war to see some journalists in Iraq carrying in their backpack books by Gertrude Bell and so on. I mean, there are actually more. There was Charles Tripp's book, you know, which is the Cambridge History of Iraq, essentially. It's not a bad book. Why don't you read that? They are carrying books from the colonial days to understand Iraq. That was bizarre. you know, for 2003, but not really. It's either that or it's Lonely Planet. So the relationship of how you tell the story of now is so rooted in how you understand the past, and therefore from what perspective you understand the past. And I think it's not fashionable to talk about the anti-colonial perspective. And I think that's what I meant by covering it from the global south. It's the anti-colonial perspective that is so deeply unfashionable. You know, you sound like a hectoring person when you apparently keep going back to the past. Like, why can't we stay in the present? You know, why do you have to read about the history of Syria to understand what's happening in Syria? All you need to understand is Assad is a butcher. If you get that Assad is a butcher, then that's the ticket to entry into the conversation at the Carnegie's, in the New York Times. You just need, that's a ticket of entry. You don't need to study the history, the complexity. You don't have to understand that Assad is a product of a history. You just have to say he's a butcher, and then the story writes itself. Then you have to say, well, look, it's civilians dying. It's a, you know. So it's the question of perspective, of this anti-colonial perspective that I think should define our kind of counter-journalism or the journalism from the other side. I just want to say that it's, I mean, I'm largely write for mainstream publications in India. I don't write for, you know, I write for what's known as India's leading news magazine. And I've written for them for 25 years every fortnight. You count how many articles that is. From, you know, Chiapas to Iraq, I've covered all these things, you know, from FARC in Colombia. I mean, it's a great ride, friends. Have enjoyed it thoroughly. But, you know, my editor would not understand an article if the premise of the article was that history doesn't matter. Nor would my readers, frankly. They would be bewildered by an ahistorical understanding of the present. And that has to do with the residues of anti-colonial perspective in our society. Those residues have never been there in France. France, French people are taught to believe they are a republic. How are you a republic? Drop of a hat, you'll bomb Côte d'Ivoire, you'll bomb Mali, you'll have the French franc be the currency of the, you know, the African countries that speak French. How are you a republic? Where is the republican thing, friends? Go back, read about Haiti. So I'll meet my French colleagues and I'll say, guys, you're colonialists, you know. As they say in the movie Black Panther, don't scare me, colonizer.
The extraordinary situation we have is that there's a meeting about Syria, and the meeting is between Iran, Turkey, and Russia. About 100 years ago, similar meetings were held in Paris and London between Britain and France. So if you go back over a century, you see that external powers are still largely shaping the configuration of internal Arab countries or Arab societies that the British made into countries and now are going to be remade into something else. How do you interpret, from your perspective, which I fully agree with, how do you interpret the fact that Russia, Turkey, and Iran are now the powers that are trying to redefine Syria, and including the Russians writing draft constitutions and things like that?
That's a very fine question. If you have weak states and weak regionalism, and your regionalism is not allowed to develop effectively, this is what's going to happen. I mean, look at the Arab League. Where is the history of the Arab League that is an honest history? You know, you go back and you read what some of the more revolutionary people used to say of the Arab League. They would say things like, don't bother to bomb Israel, go bomb that building in downtown Cairo. In other words, the Arab League. It's ineffectual, it's unable to bring people. But the Arab League was merely the mirror of unfinished problems in this region. In other words, what was the Arab League? You've been to enough meetings to know there were always two sections. The Saudi-led section, and then for years the Algerian-led section. The kind of revolutionary, secular, nationalist crowd, and then the you know, the Emiratis, the this, the that. I mean, you cannot have a weak region and not have external powers enter. You know, it's if you look at other countries, other areas, they fight off. I mean, in that sense, there is really something to be learned from what the Chinese are now doing in Eastern Asia. And how the Chinese have been pushing to break ASEAN, APEC, all these groupings that have Western intervention. There's something to be learned from why the Bolivarian project wanted to destroy the free trade area of the Americas. That was one of the first things Chavez, Morales, etc. did in the early 2000s. And replace it with ALBA, their own formation. And they forced the Organization of American States to accept Cuba for the first time and to say the Americans don't have a seat at the table because this is our regional organization. It makes no sense in South America and Central America to have the United States at the table. If you have the United States, why not Canada? You know, why not have the whole hemisphere? And then why can't the OAS pass resolutions about, you know, Flint, Michigan, water crisis? You know, Americans should not neglect their population. Why is it that OAS is always criticizing Mexico, which, by the way, deserves to be criticized? So the question was not about, you know, what they say. I'm not talking about the politics. I'm talking about the regional integrity. You have to have a strong sense of being in the region. And so when they got rid of the American seat briefly and the Cubans came on board, that was in a way the high point of South American or Latin American integration. High point. But of course it went downhill from there. What I'm saying is that in a way, of course they'll intervene. Big powers always intervene. In the case of the Russians, the interesting phenomena is that in this part of the world, writing about Russia has been, I think, quite parochial. It's been about Russia in Syria. But if you look at Russia globally, Russia has, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, only two warm water ports. One was in Crimea, in Sevastopol, and one was in Syria, in the province of Latakia. It's interesting that both these warm water ports were threatened in the second term of the Obama administration, when the United States government helped overthrow the Russian-backed government in Ukraine. They were going to lose Sevastopol. And then in Syria, if there was a change of guard, they would have lost Tartus port. So the Russians were interested in maintaining their two ports. They have no other warm water ports. That is, in the Pacific Ocean, those ports freeze in the winter. The Americans, meanwhile, have over 100 warm water ports, including in Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, from which the bombing runs on Iraq were made. Island where there's still a court case going on in London, brought by the Chagos Islanders. They are the ones who were displaced from the base by the British in what the British and Europeans call Diego Garcia. They call it Chagos. That's another warm water. The Russians had two. Now, I'm not carrying a bucket for the Russians. These conversations are so ugly because if you say anything to push back against something, right, you get, oh my God, but then you are a Putin supporter or whatever. I'm a supporter of nobody. But here, see, the point is, we have to understand what their game is. And there is an opening. I mean, the question is, why are there so many foreign military ports in the Middle East? That's the question. I mean, in Qatar, I was once driving in the desert with a taxi, a South Asian taxi driver. I said to him, drive me to the border of Saudi Arabia. Let's just go for a drive. Why? Along the way, you may not know, but you pass American base. About several miles before the base, a jeep pulled up and stopped us and said, you can't go any further. They were Americans. I thought this is supposed to be some sort of country called Qatar. God knows what kind of country it is. In South Korea, in the malls, you go to buy a ticket to see a movie, in the line there'll be American soldiers armed. Imagine in Beirut, if there were at the mall, Chinese soldiers with guns in the queue to see Black Panther. That would shock you, you know. Or Russian soldiers standing in the queue, just routinely going to see a film, armed. So there is a very strange way in which you have allowed your region to become the lily pads of violence, you know, from one end of the region to the other. This goes back to World War II, some of it, to British bases and so on. You've never reclaimed your territory. I mean, the Cubans from 1959 have been fighting to remove the U.S. base in Guantanamo. From 59. I have never really heard of a struggle in this region to remove a base. I've never heard of a struggle. Never. In fact, in Africa, when the Americans created AFRICOM, African Command, no African country would publicly allow African Command to come, which is why it's based in Stuttgart. There are tons of American bases that I have seen in Africa. The African countries are too embarrassed to allow it to be made public. In Agadez, the base, as I said, is the biggest base. You can go to Google Earth and see it. It's one of the largest bases in the world. It was built only for merely $100 million. That's because the price of labor in Niger is nothing. So the point I'm trying to make is you open the door, they're going to come in. And you're not standing up for yourself. What's happening is the top of the iceberg. Underneath that is this deep rot of the lack of confidence to say we want our sovereignty back.
Considering this, the past 10 years of the axis of hope, what some people called it, we have now the left movement swiped completely. What do you think are the next steps towards reviving or to begin again this leftist movement in Latin America? Thank you.
It's true that the left is suffering a major defeat in Latin America. It's completely true. It'll take time to analyze exactly, precisely what has happened. I've been going recently to Brazil, and Brazil, there was a kind of soft coup against the Lula establishment. You know, Lula was already out of thing. Dilma was, I think, very viciously removed from power by a man with ancestry. How can I not indicate this ancestry from Lebanon, Mr. Temer, who is one of the most unpopular people in Brazil. Not just political leader, but I think he's even more unpopular than the gangsters that are there. In fact, if the election was now, Lula would win by a landslide. But they are trying through legal means to prevent him from standing, which is a very interesting mechanism. So two of the most important aspects, I think, to research more, and I'm not making these conclusive statements. One is that none of these countries produced a revolution. In the sense that in none of the countries, the deepest of which was Venezuela, none of these countries was the elite expropriated. In none of the countries did they lose their wealth. In none of the countries did the media get democratized. And at no point did these governments, no point were they strong enough to actually produce an alternative media. The second thing to investigate, so the first is, this was not really a revolution in the sense that they expropriated people. You know, there was no guillotine in the center of Caracas. Okay? Not that that's a way to go forward, guys. I don't mean that. I'm just saying that there was no real expropriation. Second thing is that they relied on commodity prices. When commodity prices are high, it's easy to be spending lavishly building Telesur, you know. When commodity prices collapse, you are in distress. You cannot build a revolution grounded on commodity prices. And I think that those are the two things we need to investigate. What are the alternatives? You cannot import your dreams. You have to create them yourself.
My question comes down to basically where do you come from in terms of what you stand for. And I, you know, throughout the talk, there are times when you seem to make a stand for the global south, other times for regionalism, other times for communism, other times for nationalism, other times for anti-colonialism, other times for a general notion of freedom, which kind of sits in a liberal humanist framework. Mm. And so I think I'd just like to hear a little bit more about where you come from.
I mean, I personally am a Marxist. That's my orientation, political, theoretical orientation. which is why I'm very interested in the idea of context and setting context and perspective and so on. But I'm all the things you said. I'm all those things. May not be liberal humanist. I'll sort of draw the line there. But I'm all those things in the sense that, you know, I read the work of somebody like, say, Frantz Fanon, and I find that to be stimulating for me personally, intellectually, and I look at the work of the All India Women's Democratic Association, and I see how they have developed an analysis of why it is that, you know, women's freedom in India is compromised, and I think, wow, they are intellectuals that I should pay attention to. But more than anything else, I think the question isn't what label you have or, you know, your framework you have. The real question is, do you believe firmly that indignity is completely unacceptable in our world? That it's not a question of should people eat or whatever, but do you believe that people should live dignified lives? Now, if that's not your belief, then it's a struggle. If that is too vague an idea, you know, an idea that everybody agrees with. What's that Janis Joplin song? Freedom is another word with, you know, whatever it is. Yeah, nothing left to lose. I mean, you know, okay, I got it. Dignity, everybody agrees with dignity. Actually, that's not true. What was the slogan from Egypt? I mean, dignity is not so easy, friends. Soviet Revolution 100 years ago, the slogan was land, peace, and bread. Land, peace, and bread. Irish Rebellion, land and freedom. Freedom. Freedom is a very complicated word. It doesn't mean that you don't enter it and have those debates. But I think that's fundamental to journalism, is journalists should not merely be writing about current events as if the question of freedom is not at the center of our stories. You know, what is freedom? How are people understanding freedom? What are the clashes between different understandings of freedom? What does it mean to be dignified? What is dignity? Why has somebody immolated themselves? What does that mean? Why is it that there were 500 immolations and one immolation caught the imagination of people? What does that mean? What are people searching for? I mean, if we don't ask those questions, we're dishonest. In other words, what I'm just trying to say is, who are you? A journalist, I think, has to have a perspective, has to be quite open and comfortable with it. But more than anything else, has to be honest to the people that they're listening to. I mean, honesty, I think, is a very important value for us. It's different than truth. I think honesty means when people talk to me, I shouldn't misrepresent what they're saying. I should give them the dignity to stand with what they say. Now, I may not agree with them, and I might want to argue with them. But then I should go talk to somebody else to argue with them. Or find a way to give them their space, but yet argue with them. So I would say, what am I? I'm all those things except perhaps a liberal humanist. Because I don't want to just be a dreamer. Thanks a lot.
That was Vijay Prashad on Truth is the First Casualty of War. He spoke at the American University of Beirut. Vijay Prashad is a journalist and scholar. He's chief editor of Leftward Books and executive director of Transcontinental Institute for Social Research. He's the author of many books, including Arab Spring, Libyan Winter, and The Death of a Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Abby Martin, Ramsey Baroud, Nancy McLean, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Michael Parenti, and Noam Chomsky. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Mohammed Temraoui and Rayan Alamin. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.